We have a quorum. I'll call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And I suppose if I looked, I could find the minutes in my... If you'd study the minutes very quickly, please, and somebody make a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the minutes.
Oh, yeah, Representative Dowd moves the minutes from the, was it March 15th? Any comments, discussion, questions?
Yes.
We have a typo. I don't, we'll just put an O there. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Mayo was misspelled in one point. That's okay, our first bill today, House File 560. Representative Downey. Welcome to the Committee on Higher Education.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative,
yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move Representative Downey's House File 560 to and recommend it to be passed and referred to the Committee on Government Affairs Operations.
Okay, we have the bill in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pardon my looking around. I'm looking for actually a testifier, but
And Mr. Chair, I see we have an amendment.
Thank you.
A1 amendment.
Yes.
And I would. Also move the A1 amendment.
Do you want to describe what the amendment does?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, you can look and see the technical wording changes. The intent of this is actually to open up and take some of the controls off. There was a 2-year period in terms of some of these energy forward options. And actually, the University of Minnesota is doing some things longer than that, so we simply took off those kind of controlling provisions and leave it a little wide open in terms of the mechanisms and the time frame of them.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes, prevails. Okay. Has your testifier arrived yet?
No, I can explain the bill, and then I actually have two universities here as well, so they could go forward, and if the other fellow doesn't make it, we'll just proceed with that. Yeah.
As you know, identify yourself.
Yeah.
We're not sure, and then
thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Keith Downey. Glad to be back in front of the committee. Spent my first term on this committee and really enjoyed it, so it's good to be back, at least in this capacity. So House File 560 is actually, I hope, a fairly straightforward bill for your consideration. Right now, in statute, there are provisions that allow you to do energy forward pricing and procurements, and the intent of that, obviously, is to try and smooth out and make more predictable an organization, a public sector entity's energy prices by buying ahead. And so the scope of this bill, we expand the availability and use of this option to the entire state and local government complex, whereas right now there are opportunities for Hennepin County and Met Council specifically provided, and while there's nothing in statute that says you can't do it, I guess kind of implicit in the specific mention of Met Council and Hennepin County, one might infer that they're the only ones that can do it. And so this is really intended to kind of open up this whole opportunity. And interestingly, the University of Minnesota has been doing this quite successfully. So they're a little bit of a case study for the intent of this bill. And so I think rather than trying to explain all the sections of the bill, maybe I'll just have the university describe what they're doing and the benefits they're realizing. And if my other testifier comes, he can do the same. You'll notice there are two handouts from Mr. Lemunyan, who hopefully will make it here. But if not, you can see a letter in terms of a project that he and his firm are doing. I think it's with an organization in the state of Florida, and an overview presentation of how this all works, PowerPoint presentation that you can look at as well. But with that, I'll let the university run through their materials.
Okay. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Bertelson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Facilities Management for the Twin Cities campus at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for a chance to talk about the positive opportunities from forward energy pricing. Just as a point of note, to make sure we're thinking about to set the stage, the University of Minnesota for multiple campuses is over 28 million square feet. We have many different unique facilities, lots of historical and very technical facilities, which really comes down to say we use a lot of energy. On the next slide, you can see for the Twin Cities campus itself, the mix of fuel that we use from our steam plant for our production. Roughly 2,800 million BTU of steam of fuel that we use and burn, 70% of which is natural gas. And why is that important to us? Natural gas is the most volatile of the pricing for the fuels. And if you look, turn to the next page, it's both our largest fuel we use the most of, and we can see the kind of pricing that we've seen over the last decade. It's gone from as low as 2 to as high as 14 in a period of only 4 years, and it bounces back again. And so it can be all over the place. And when that large of a purchase for the university, which is our fuel budget, is $14.5 million, at this kind of price, when it's at a low point, you can imagine if that went from 4 to 14, that would have a substantial impact to the institution. So what has the university done since we've been involved in buying forward pricing for natural gas since 1993? In fact, we're still living with one of those contracts we bought in 93 that was for 25 years and expires in 2017. Though was maybe questioned at the time, had paid huge dividends to the institution by buying ahead. How do we try to manage that for us? Again, the goal is to manage risk, provide some price and budget certainty, as well as manage the price volatility and hopefully beat the market, which is always a challenge for all of us as we think about investments. We use a university protocol and purchasing plan that establishes guidelines and that guides our purchasing decisions. We have a cross-functional team of energy management, finance officers, and our office of investment and banking who makes investment choices for the institution involved. In addition, we also use market expertise, and a Minnesota energy company provide us advice and counsel as we make these decisions and look ahead. Finally, on the last page, just to give you an impact of how we've done over the last 9 years, you can see that net over that time, for the volume of natural gas we bought with advanced purchasing versus what the market gas would have been, we've been able to save cumulatively $27.6 million net versus if we had just bought on the market based on what as the price would have fluctuated. And which turns out to be an average of $2.9 million. What I didn't show up on this chart, though, is actually in 2010, we actually had a negative impact. It would have about a loss of about $1.2 million versus what it would have been if we bought in the market. Why is that important to tell you is that any kind of advanced purchasing comes with some risk. But I think, say, from an overall perspective, you're trying to manage that risk is all, and that can go either way. But from a cumulative overall, from an average perspective, over this period of time, it has been very positive for the institution. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Darden.
Thank you. And this goes way outside my area of expertise, so I apologize if the question isn't a good one. But envisioning what you just mentioned about the 2010 numbers, is there anything that can be done in the writing of a contract that would have a ceiling or cap amount of loss in order to protect the university or the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there are things you can do, and it depends on how complicated you want to get into this kind of place. The university has chosen to be relatively simple and straightforward and not to get too complicated. And we've adopted principles as the bill outlines that to set limits. So this has not become a financial investment strategy. It becomes a purchasing. So we don't cap how much, so we don't try to go off and do huge volumes more than we would actually use. It's about how to manage the cost itself. So there are things about calls and puts, and now I'm entering a place that I don't understand, which is why we have investment advisors to do so. There are things you can do to limit it. And why did we lose this money this last time? Well, the price dropped precipitously, and we had been buying ahead and finding good prices, but when the price dropped that far, it even fell below what we had, and which is one of the reasons we typically don't buy ahead 100% of what we're doing. Is to, like any of your investment strategies, you want to have layers.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Testifier. Are the other campuses, the other University of Minnesota campuses, following suit in this management process?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are working with all the campuses together as a group under this policy. Applies to the University of Minnesota for all the campuses. Each of the depending on the campus on where they buy and how they buy, it allows them to engage in this process more or less. But yes, they're all involved.
Mr. Chair, one addition to the answer there, I think part of what's envisioned here is that as we look at shared services and local units of government and local school districts doing things together, obviously the opportunity for doing this for larger purchases, your effectiveness and opportunity for success increases too. And I know my own school district, I think, saved maybe $300,000 on fuel costs last year, which really helped in terms of their annual budget. But just think if it had gone the other way. And so here's one school district, with that kind of a risk exposure. So I think part of the taking off of some of the conditions here and opening it up a little more means that a lot of different organizations, local governments, local school districts, everybody could think about whether or not there's an opportunity for them, either on their own or by banding together to take advantage of these kinds of techniques.
Representative Depke.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Downey, for bringing this forward. As a former chair of the Wayzata School District, we also started doing this about 6 or 7 years ago, because as a result of our energy costs in 1 year, when the prices spiked, went up about $300,000, and we have saved thousands and thousands of dollars over the last 6 years. So we are doing it. We have an oversight process through a Citizens Financial Advisory Board, which is made up of business experts and so forth in the community that oversee it. And we get an annual report. So I think for those districts that are already doing it, that's great. And I'm just surprised that we haven't done that at the U, other organizations. You have done it. And that's the point of the whole thing. I apologize.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. Very good. I didn't have a question. I'm sorry. I just wanted to support that.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the university, can you describe for me the investment counseling that you receive, or the investment committee? Who makes the ultimate decision?
Mr. Berthelsen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we operate, we do an annual plan that's reviewed by the Vice President for Finance, Fitzenreiter, and Vice President for University Services, Kathleen O'Brien. And within that plan, it gives certain purchasing parameters to the energy management, finance, and our Office of Investment. So those parties meet and talk a couple times a month to review where we are, what the market looks like, get a weekly update from our energy advisor for what the market looks like, what the trends are, so that if we're buying within the parameters of the annual plan, it's a joint decision between energy management, finance, and our Office of Banking. If we wanted to see something outside of that bounds, we would go to the Vice President of Finance with a proposal.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, my sense is it's a fairly sophisticated both energy and investment decision. And my question, more so for the chief author and for the testifier that I hope has arrived by now, is relative to the level of sophistication necessary to make a decision like that. I have no doubt that the university has the capacity to do so. but you can also lose an awful lot of money. We've had a historic trend where since the mid-90s that's gone the right direction, and you've saved $27 million relative to it. My concern is if folks bet wrong, the point of options and hedging is that you can also lose a huge amount of money, depending on the parameters within which your investment strategy allows you to invest. There apparently, Representative Downey, I don't see any parameters other than that you'd have to have an investment committee, and it sounds like you have a very good one where you are. I'd just be deeply concerned about there were a whole bunch of folks back in about 1997 that within their investment parameters, and they were pretty sophisticated folks, they bought derivatives. My guess is the university owned a few derivatives back in the late 90s, and folks lost huge amounts of money. That is what my concern would be, is that you are going to find some modest-sized communities that think this is a great idea, and it is, but within a certain fixed set of parameters. My suggestion relative to the bill, and perhaps a testifier can allay some of my concerns, is that you ought to establish those parameters within the context of the bill as well, because I can see some city somewhere that runs a little outside the lines with it, and next thing they're looking for the chief author of this bill, Representative Downey. Who would have ever allowed this?
That's right.
Even though it worked out really well for a lot of folks, it doesn't get into the newspaper until something goes terribly bad.
Mr. Chair, response, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, great points. And you can see in Subdivision 5, we do have some fairly broad language about an oversight function, and you probably make a good suggestion. We might want to tighten that up a bit. You know, The reality is this capability exists out. There's nothing that precludes somebody from doing it now. So in some ways, I don't want to say it's the Wild West, but we're trying to put some parameters in here and actually tighten it up a little bit and encourage the opportunity of shared services and leveraging this to larger organizations that really have the sophistication to do it. So you raised some really good points. And I think one generalized comment, and then if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Lemunyan's testimony could actually address Representative Atkins' question. You know, I think the overriding value here is predictability. This doesn't somehow magically allow you to buy cheap fuel when prices are going up. It does allow you to avoid some of the really big spikes, and on average, compared to what you might have experienced if you were just buying it on the fly or trying to just buy in bulk ahead of time. Using options does allow you to smooth that out, and in general, no guarantees, in general would also have a price advantage as well. And it actually does save you money, relatively speaking, in negative trends as well. But anyway, with that, Mr. Chair, maybe it'd be an appropriate time for Mr.
I just have one quick short question, I guess. I know natural gas and oil have been fluctuating a lot. Price of coal and oat hulls, are they pretty stable in price?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they certainly do have some fluctuation, but the range is dramatically smaller. We have seen some upward pressure for both of them, but the range is dramatically smaller and much more consistent.
All right. Representative Downey, you have another testifier?
Yes, if the Chair would like, Mr. Lemunyan is here to provide a few more details on how the mechanism actually works.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Lemunyan, and my company, Linwood Capital, is based here in the Twin Cities and is a fuel hedging advisor primarily for public entities throughout the country. We create and manage fuel hedging programs for public transit and municipalities and other public entities to help them control their price risk that they experience in their normal course of business as being a fuel consumer.
All right. Glad you could make it today. Is there anything further?
My pleasure. Well,
You have a handout, I believe, that
exactly.
We all have.
Okay. Going through the short presentation that you had, can fuel costs be controlled? The answer is yes, they can, and that's through hedging. And hedging, very simply, is deciding today what tomorrow's price is going to be. So unlike going to the fuel pump where you're going to price it and buy it and consume it all at the same time. This is breaking that apart. You're deciding ahead of time what your fuel costs are going to be. And so the result of doing this is that you have lower fuel price or fuel budget risk, a higher certainty of future fuel costs, lower fuel cost volatility, and the daily pricing for that commodity that you're consuming as a public entity is no longer determined by the fuel market, but you're doing that typically via financial contracts in advance. Financial contracts including gasoline and diesel fuel futures, natural gas futures, and the like. To the next page, simply showing the effectiveness of using financial instruments as a hedge for petroleum and natural gas products, the correlation is typically very high. All this means is that when you put the hedge on with a financial instrument, if the price that you're experiencing at the pump goes up by a dollar a gallon, the price of the financial instrument will also go up by a dollar a gallon, thus offsetting the price increase that you're experiencing. The next page that shows two graphs shows the graph on the left with the line in the middle is price expectations, and we can directly observe this through forward pricing curves in the futures markets. And as you can see in both graphs, the center line is exactly the same. The upper and lower bands are very different. The graph on the left-hand side indicates the upper and lower bands of probability to where fuel prices could go. On the left, we see what a 90% hedged position would look like as far as expected costs. And you can see that that is greatly managed and collapsed around the expected costs. What that means from a practical standpoint is if you're 90% hedged and prices at the pump go up by a dollar a gallon, your costs will go up by 10 cents a gallon. To the next page, why is fuel hedging advantageous? Better planning, budgeting, and forecasting. This is especially important for public entities. More efficient capital structure, not the need for the reserves to be held in case fuel costs go higher. The need for that would be eliminated, and increasing in overall organizational efficiency. Especially public entities, in my opinion, even more than private industry, simply because there are no shareholders to absorb higher fuel costs in the form of lower earnings, difficult to pass it along to customers, and also public entities don't have any of the competitive forces that private industry experiences. The following page shows a long-term graph of the results of a hedging program. The more volatile line is the spot price of diesel fuel from the beginning of 2000 to the end of 2010, and the smoother line is the cost of the fuel net of the hedge. So as you can see, it is a smoother line, less volatility, more predictability into what that cost is going to be. But what I wanted to illustrate here is that there are times when the spot price is significantly above and significantly below what the net cost turns out to be. And so that is the expectation of a hedging program, that over the course of the very long term that the realized gains and realized losses would add to zero, and that the benefit that you get along the way is having the certainty of cost in the near term and budget certainty as well. Examples. Okay. On the next page, just a mechanical forward pricing example. Forward pricing, in this case, an increase. So, for example, a budget of $2.60 per gallon, and this is again referring to petroleum, and for a particular month, the actual cost from the supplier turns out to be $3 a gallon, and this particular organization is consuming 300,000 gallons for that month, so the fuel supplier is going to send an invoice for $900,000. During the preceding 2 years, perhaps, six forward pricing contracts were taken that correspond to that particular month, which is 252,000 gallons of petroleum, And in this example, they were purchased at a price of $2.50 per gallon. The average price now, because you were paying the supplier $3 a gallon, is indicating a 50-cent rise since we put that, since this example put the hedge on, meaning that there would be a 50-cent per gallon realized gain because of the financial contracts. Times the number of gallons gives us a positive from the contracts of $126,000. Netting that against the invoice from the supplier gives us a net fuel cost of $774,000, or $2.58 a gallon, which is within the budget parameter. To the next page, same example. The budget is $2.60 per gallon, but instead of prices increasing from $2.50 to $3, prices have decreased from $2.50 to $2 in this example. So $2 a gallon, same 300,000 gallons from the supplier, pay the supplier $600,000, and then there will be a realized loss of $126,000, giving a net fuel price of $2.42 per gallon. What is important here is to look at the results of the financial instrument and your costs at the pump together. If you don't look at them together, none of it really makes much sense. So,
all right. Questions? Representative Rukabino.
Mr. Lemonian, so obviously you're not doing this because you're a nice guy. You make a little bit of money off this, right?
Exactly.
And how do you, is it on a percentage you saved or lost for them? Or
No, it isn't. My services, Mr. Chairman, Representative, my services are available on a monthly, a flat monthly fee.
And do you do this, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lemonian, for like a U.S. Steel or a Monson Trucking, or where do you do most of your business?
Mr. Chair, Lemonian? Mr. Representative, most of my clients are public entities, and I focus my efforts on public transit around the country. Examples of that would be the Washington State Ferry System, New Jersey Transit, the transit property in Cleveland, Ohio, and St. Louis.
And Mr. Lemonian, is this a big company? Do you have a lot of employees, or is this something you kind of do on your
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, it is my own company and very small. I have two people at this stage of the game.
Well, you got a couple of people, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lemonian, and that's good because, you know, Representative Downey says government doesn't create any jobs, but in your case, they created two, so at least two. So I'm glad to see that, because since most of your work is done with public. But I do have to ask you, in order to do this, you have to put some money up, obviously, up front. Or how does it work?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, to do this, there is a number of different ways to do it. Futures contracts can be used where the entity can directly address the futures markets themselves, or they can go through a financial intermediary such as a bank and get contracts through the bank as well. My role in the process is one of an advisor and a manager, and I do not handle my clients' capital.
Mr. Chair, so like at the university now, when I think your numbers show, Mr. Chair, that you might be cutting the university up to $162 million over the next biennium, if my figures are right. How do they get the capital to, I think I'd hedge at, you know, you got to have some extra capital to do this, and obviously with what's going on here at the Capitol, no pun intended, you might put a little pressure on the university to be able to continue this program, unless, of course, they charge the kids a little more tuition so they can buy some cheaper fuel for them. But, Mr. Lemonian, that's not directed towards you. I'm kind of just pounding a little bit on
I felt the jab.
So, no, that was my
comment. Are you done? Thank you, Representative Bucabino. Representative Atkins is next.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lemonian, I don't care if you make money. I think that's the American way, and you seem like a pretty nice guy besides. But My question has to do with the amendment that went on, because I very much agree with Representative Bepke, Representative Downey, that and the folks from the U. I think this is a terrific strategy to engage in if you understand it. The challenge, though, is that when you remove lines 1 through 3 on page 2, you then potentially dramatically increase the risk. I mean, we're at the same time, Representative Downey, we're trying to decrease the relative risk relative to or regarding fuel budgets. Potentially, by removing lines 1 through 3, you could dramatically increase a particular city's risk. If you have, well, we wouldn't allow a city or a school district to buy lottery tickets, and by not having lines 1 through 3, you essentially do. And Mr. Lemonian, I'd kind of like to engage you on the topic. If you see lines 1 through 3, that in the original bill, that capped the amount that a city or a school district could hedge at the quantity of energy affected by the forward pricing mechanism must not exceed 90%. You took out the 90%, so it would be 100% of the estimated energy use for that agency for the same period, which shall not exceed 24 months. By taking out those three lines, they could, as I understand it now, they could hedge against or buy options for as far out as they wanted to and for as much as they wanted to. That, to me, folks, is the equivalent. I won't vote for the bill if it's drafted in this way. That's the equivalent of allowing them to engage in buying lottery tickets if they want to. And Mr. Lemonian, maybe you can talk about, without any caps and without sophisticated investment strategy, you could use this as a city to try to make a whole bunch of money. If you had three members of township board or something like that that wanted to really go nuts, they could buy out for decades if they wanted to. They could also buy an unlimited amount of options and then try to make money in the resale market of their fuel options, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative, clearly in any well-crafted policy and strategy that an entity that's contemplating this would put together, they would limit that themselves insofar as they would be given that latitude in this legislation to do that. Certainly all of my clients that I advise and their boards need to sign off on all of these things, that they do not have the ability to go more than 100% of their expected usage. Some of them move further forward to 36 months forward, or in some cases with my natural gas clients even further forward than that. So I guess that is certainly prudent. I can't speak to what people would or wouldn't do given the latitude.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, you're making some really good points, and I'm not hard and fast on some of these things. Actually, I might ask the university to come back down and explain. They had a rationale behind some of this amendment, and they might be able to explain what they're doing. But if the concern is we're opening the funnel a little too wide here in state law, I'm glad to put the guardrails up that are appropriate here without overly constraining the effectiveness of the program for somebody like the U. So, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, and we could have the university come back down and speak to this too.
You said that was okay. I said it's okay too.
Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our concern primarily had to do with the length of the time, because we already have existing futures purchased in excess of what the law said. Our policy is much along the lines that you discussed, Representative. It's not our intent to make an investment strategy. We have a different committee for that. There's different people. My goal is just to buy our natural gas as effectively as we can. So I think from a percent perspective, the university doesn't have a concern really around that, the topic of not exceeding what you plan to use. I think that's a prudent, that's part of our policy. As to the timing, that becomes I don't know exactly what the magic number is. our view horizon tends to be primarily 36 months ahead. So as we're putting together, we're always looking at the year plus the next biennium. So as we come prepare our budgets to thinking about you, we want to be thinking about, as we look at the next biennial budget, we're already looking through that whole time period to try to get some price certainty. Once upon a time we were able to get a 25-year contract. We don't know anybody who's offering 25 years today. Will they ever again? I don't know. A lot of changes in the natural gas market. There's different ways to find new reserves in the country. Maybe that'll change again. So we're somewhat reluctant to try to put too restrictive of a time frame. I think we certainly would at least like to have three. Some time frame. I understand the concern. I'd say three for us would be a minimum concern. I mean, if we're really, but a little bit longer. I mean, the existing one we have, I'm assuming from the way the bill is written, we wouldn't do anything about the one we signed in '93 going ahead. The people we've talked to in the market, we've seen in places who are willing to, that we could potentially find up to 5 years with someone, but that's as far as we've seen anybody willing to buy, and we didn't like their pricing, so we didn't buy it. So I don't know exactly what that magic number is, but I understand your concern.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate both your testimony and the fact that Representative Downey was behind you going for.
Oh.
I think you make a good case for being able to go out a certain period, and the fact that nobody's looking at 25 years anymore. But if we were to add back in the language that was removed on lines 2.1 through 2.3 and just change the 24 months to 48 months, and I'm looking to the chief author, that would give my blood pressure a rest. All it takes is one little town says, boy, we can make a lot of money on this with a guy like Lemonian here helping us, although you counseled not to do that, I'm sure. But all it takes is one, and it would kill the whole program. Nobody would ever be able to do it again. So with that, I would move, and I'd hope to get a nod from Representative Downey to add back the language on lines 2.1 to 2.3 and change 24 months to 48 months.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I'd consider that friendly, and I'm not sure if it's easiest, I'm not sure of the parliamentary appropriateness, but I'm willing to incorporate Representative Atkins' oral amendment as compared to everybody voting on it, but I'll defer to the chair on how to approach it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms. Novak.
Mr. Chair, I believe we also have to reverse the changes on the Detmer amendment on lines 1.2. It may be better to reconsider the amendment and kind of start over and then just change the 24 months.
Whatever works for you, Mr. Chair.
So, Representative Octavino?
Question? Not to the amendment, Mr.
Chair. Oh, okay. So we need to reconsider your original or your amendment? Okay. Ms. Novak, can you restate that then? Do we all?
Mr. Chair, I would suggest we do it in two steps, and the first would be if Representative Detmer would move to reconsider his amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider my amendment.
Okay. Motion's been made. And all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Okay. We've reconsidered it. Now? A new motion?
And then the new motion would be on page 2, line 3, delete 24 and insert 48.
Representative Detmer, do you want to move that?
I move that on line 2.3, delete 24 and insert 48.
Okay, exactly. Representative Benson.
Sounds like we're progressing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like we're progressing towards that. I see the logic in putting the brakes on just an open-ended. But before we make a decision that it's 48, Can the testifier speak to the length of contracts that you have with those other entities? Is it, I mean, would it be prudent to say 36, maybe it's 60 months? Could you give us some idea of, in other market areas, what you've been doing?
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently my clients, and because of constraints in how far forward hedging contracts go for petroleum futures, they most uniformly have a constraint of 36 months. That's not to say that they couldn't be allowed to go further than that, but that is a market constraint and not so much a policy constraint. Certainly with any hedging policy that I would contemplate for any of my clients, 48 months would certainly be sufficient.
Okay, we're ready to vote on the amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Okay. Anything further? Representative Rukavina.
I'm just curious. Who made the motion, and where's the bill going next? Because it deals with, you know, cities and counties. And
the motion was made by Representative Detmer.
Where did you send it, Representative
Detmer? Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina is going to be going to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay, I was just wondering. Okay. I thought this might show up in the bill on Tuesday.
No. Representative Downey, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair, thanks. It was actually good and helpful, and we got a couple more stops, so if people have some lingering concerns, I'm glad to consider them.
Representative Downey, I just wonder, Representative Downey,
Representative, maybe next
week, could you tell me how many more people in Edina are making money off the government, like Mr. Lamont?
Representative Detmer, do you want to renew the motion?
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion as amended. Pass be referred to the Committee of Government Operations.
House File 560. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. Great. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
All right, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill?
I do. First, I'd like to move House File 1133 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay. This bill simply encourages higher education systems to offer students a guaranteed tuition option in addition to the annual tuition rate that may fluctuate from year to year. So. As we just talked about all this hedging and fluctuation and all that, this is kind of along that same lines, I guess, is what we're looking at. Giving students the option of maybe making a selection of a guaranteed tuition rate over a two-year or four-year term. For students enrolling in the baccalaureate degree program at the state university, the guaranteed tuition rate would be locked in for 4 years. And then the tuition rate for each semester in excess of the 4 years would be equal to the rate paid by new enrollees. For students enrolling in the associate degree program at a college, the guaranteed tuition rate would be locked in for 2 years. For such an option to be financially feasible, the colleges and the universities, the guaranteed rate would almost certainly have to be higher to offset the annual rate. But it would allow students to plan for a stable rate so that they know what their risk would be or what they'd be facing over the next 2 or 4 years. In addition to providing a stable rate, these students can better plan for that. So with that, I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
You have no testifiers? No
testifiers. At
any
this
questions,
point.
Representative Vogel? Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Vogel, this is an idea I've long thought about myself, sitting on the other side as a faculty member. And one of the things that at one of our public universities. And one of the things that I think about when we do this is, first of all, this is just an encouragement. So there's no
mandate here.
There is no mandate on this, right? Representative Vogel, one of the things that I would want to hear is if we were offering this plan that the university and Minsky institutions would also be able somehow to provide assurances that within 4 years someone could actually earn a degree. Sometimes we have we have course requirements and majors that don't get met within a 4 year period. Is there anything that you might consider toward encouraging that as well, to make it such that our students could, who wanted to be on this 4 year plan would actually be given a course of study that would allow them to graduate within the time in your guarantee?
Representative Vogel?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Banyan, I believe, I'd be open to looking at something like that. I hear what you're saying, that in some degree departments that it may take longer. So sure. We're open to that.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
Okay. Representative Benson, did you have a comment?
A comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just an acknowledgement that in as much as we want our students, my children at least, to get through in 4 years, many of them can't seem to make up their mind in the first couple of years. So I don't know how difficult it might be to fashion something beyond the four-year program. That's when we'd like for them to get done. Mm-hmm. However, depending on how active they are in clubs and social things, they may not take a full load and find themselves in a position to graduate in 4 years. So I think it would overly complicate what you're trying to do. I appreciate this. Some of it may be institutional because of the lack of available things, but I think in most cases, in at least my experience, it has to do more with student choices than it does academic choices.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. And Representative Benson's correct. Goodness knows, and I'm looking over at Representative Poppy, who's probably had the same experience with students who wander aimlessly for a year or so. I kind of wandered aimlessly my first 2 years, but the issue there was I was at a private institution, and wandering was expensive, so you did it. And I think one of the things, to say something in favor of Representative Vogel's bill is that the 4 year guarantee or a 2 year guarantee might encourage better credit taking behavior by the students, and maybe get them to focus on the fact, boy, I lose this guarantee and I'm going to experience a rather substantial jump in my tuition if I'm here in year five. So there are good things to it, but I do believe we ought to be cognizant of the fact that sometimes we are encouraging students to get into programs that we tell them they can get to 4 years through in 4 years or 2 years, and then that turns out not to be true because a course is missing because of budget reductions or just the faculty member went on sabbatical that year. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm speaking of myself.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment. You said you were open to talking to others. The Iowa State University, this is a huge program for them, and they are guaranteeing the 4 years. And you might want to contact them to see how they do it. I know that when my daughter and I interviewed with them for her entrance, we were very concerned about this as parents. And they do guarantee that they will your child can graduate in 4 years. However, it's a very close contact between the counselor. It puts a lot more effort on the counseling area to really guide them through that. And so that's a critical piece of that whole thing, as other people have testified to. But they also say, if for some reason we ask the question, if you don't, let's say a course isn't available that term, they do offer it then for free at another time, because they guarantee that the child will not have to pay for more than 4 years of college if they stay the course. Okay. So it's a very interesting thought, and I just thought I'd tell you because you said you were open to other ideas.
Mm-hmm. Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Banning, I do agree with you in part. Although I would maybe note that maybe those expensive schools, they're also trying very hard, as the public's hard, to provide the guidance counseling to help folks not make their way aimlessly. But we could have a discussion about that offline, because I actually have a question for Representative Vogel. Representative Vogel, I'm stopping a little bit on the sixth word of line 1.6 and the word encouraged. So I'm just trying to understand, Representative Vogel, as I'm thinking about bills that I might be drafting, the thought behind bringing a bill that encourages somebody to do something.
Representative Vogel.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Morrow, I don't like mandates, so I'm not going to mandate the colleges to do it. I want to encourage the university systems to look at this option and begin, and maybe they have already, but I'd like to see them begin to move forward on this and give this the students an opportunity to make this a selection. It doesn't mean that they have to do this. It doesn't mean that the college has to do it. And if the colleges do provide that service and it is something that they can work on and present, it doesn't mean that the student has to accept that as well. It's still an option for the student to accept that. Therefore, if the program maybe will take longer than 4 years, as some of the suggestions have been made, maybe we can look at adjusting that. But it does encourage them to get through in 4 years if the program, course of study can be done in 4 years. Or 2 years, for that matter, in the associate's degree.
Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, for that, because as I'm thinking about the number of ideas that we've heard before this committee in informational hearing after informational hearing, I think there are probably a number of things. And so I'm hearing you, and I agree that maybe we should be encouraging and writing legislation that encourages MNSCU and encourages the University of Minnesota to do a number of things. So I'm glad that you and I are thinking along the same lines. Maybe we would bring bills now to encourage behavior. Thank you.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Vogel, I do understand that this is an optional program for universities, but however, if they do this, they need to follow these guidelines. And I, reading the language, understand that the student needs to complete their study in either 2 or 4 years. I'm wondering if you've thought about potential exceptions to that. And the one that jumps into my mind is if a student's career at a college is interrupted by maybe an active duty deployment to the military. And have you thought about the possibility of allowing an exception for that?
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dowd, yes, we have actually. I had talked with somebody about that already as an option, and at this point, or when we were talking about it, we thought we'd wait and see if that is something that we'd want to put in. We could put it in as an amendment on this, because I agree. I know that there's several students that I know out at Ridgewater College who are going to be going off to active duty here in May. So it is, I believe, an option that we could put in there.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vogel. I think that, I like the idea of this program. I think it really, provides for some stability for the students. I would really like to see that exception in there. I know that's something that students really can't plan for as an active duty deployment. So I don't know the appropriate procedure to do that. Maybe House Research could help us come up with some language for an oral amendment.
Meanwhile, Representative Urquivina, do you have a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, this is a good bill, and I think, in fact, if I recall correctly, maybe it was Representative Biskins or someone that had a similar bill for MNSCU, and then I see Mr. Zetterberg is in the audience from the U. I think the U have this program, and nobody took advantage of it. If he might want to come up and testify, well, Ms. Novak is...
if he's
writing
willing
on the amendment, and maybe we can find out what went wrong with it, or why nobody participated in it. And I don't think there's anything that prohibits MNSCU. I don't know if they've ever offered it, although I think Representative Biskins did the same type of thing. It may have been a mandate. I'm not sure, but well, let's see what happened at the U when they offered it.
Thank you, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota did offer a guaranteed tuition program from 1995 until just last year when the last cohort went through. The guarantee was for 5 years rather than four. And if it turned out that a student paid more than they would have with the regular rates, we refunded the money. So you couldn't lose. But we had only 100 to 150 students a year who were interested in it out of 40,000. And that's why we did away with it. It was an administrative burden to administer it because, in effect, you need to have six undergraduate tuition rates for each cohort going through that you're keeping track of. And I have asked myself why there was never more interest in the program. And I think that there are two main reasons. First of all, there's the initial sticker shock. If you're going to guarantee tuition for a five-year period, then the difference when you're a freshman between what that guaranteed rate is and what the rate is for new students is maybe as high as 20%. So there's an even though you'll get it back if you wind up paying more, there's an initial sticker price problem. But I think the even bigger problem is that the only way you could lose in our program is if you dropped out. We're only at the university for 1 or 3 years, 1 to 3 years, or you transferred. And frankly, when you're a freshman, you know, you're thinking about all those things. It's not clear to you that you're going to make it. Most do, but it's not clear that you're necessarily going to make it. And I think it was that risk more than anything else that's the reason why the program wasn't more popular than it was. We did it for 10 years. This wasn't a one-year deal. We tried it for 10 years. And last year I processed the last of the refunds for a student who actually had paid more than they would have otherwise. So, you know, in a nutshell, it sounds like a great idea. The advantage, obviously, is not that you're going to pay less, because you're probably not. The advantage is that it's going to be constant over a 4 or 5 year period. And for some people, that planning is very important. But in the final analysis, there was no interest in it.
In my opinion, the problem, as I would see it, is that they're charged at a higher initial tuition. To me, the ideal thing would be if they could go in at today's tuition rate and then guarantee it for 4 years. That's a deal. And I think you'd have a lot more people that would say, and it seemed to me it would be a lot simpler administratively, too. But that's just my opinion.
We would have 100% participation rate if we guaranteed tuition for 5 years.
I understand. That's just... So let's do it, huh? Representative Ben.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could ask the witness the question, what happened if they dropped out? Was it simply they paid the higher rate and did not get the refund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. Let's say a student dropped out after 2 years, it simply they wound up paying more over that two-year period than they otherwise would have. Okay. So that's the risk.
Great. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to Mr. Zetterberg as well. You know, I am a college counselor, and I work very closely with my college registrar. And I understand sometimes when there's administrative burden that means there's a cost. There's time, effort, cost. And I'm just wondering, do you have an estimated cost of what you spent extra over the course of the last few years and an estimate for what that might be in the future?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I do not. And I would not exaggerate it. It's not as though we had to have an additional person on the staff to manage this program. But there were probably six or seven of us who had to spend some time on it at some point in the year. And when you looked at that, you know, that kind of administrative burden benefiting 150 students out of 40,000, the numbers just didn't add up.
Okay. Any further questions? Otherwise... Are we working on an amendment? Representative Dowd, have you got an amendment over there?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have an oral amendment to House File 1133. On page 1, after line 24, insert becomes an additional paragraph. Paragraph E would read, time limits for the stable tuition under this section do not apply to students who have been on active military duty. And then on page 2, after line 12, we would insert the same language.
Okay. Any discussion on that language? Representative Banyan?
Just to clarify, what does do not apply mean? Does this mean you're just your clock's turned off while you're on active duty? Or does it mean you have forever? I want to be sure do not apply does not apply actually is understood. I think what we mean is something like I'm looking at Ms. Novak. I think what you mean is a time limit, right? Or it's just you flip off the clock while they're on active duty and then you turn it back on when they come back.
Mr. Chair, that's a good point. Perhaps we want to add after military duty while on military duty. While on active duty.
Oh, I see, yes. Mr. Chairman. I'm going to have to look at Mr. Dowd because I don't know if I can amend an amendment. Can I do that here? Oh, he'll get, let him or have Representative Dowd incorporate it. After the words active military duty, insert the words while on active military duty, I think does work.
Representative Dowd, do you accept the incorporate that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would incorporate that that slight change into my verbal amendment in both places.
Not on this. Okay. Any other discussion on this amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The amendment passes. Okay. Now, Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of goes back to maybe Representative Morrow's point and the discussion here. Certainly the Board of Trustees is encouraged to offer, but then on line 1.8, when you say that the guaranteed tuition plan must meet the requirements, you are actually mandating something. If I'm reading that correctly, they're encouraged to do it, but if they do it, there is a mandate, an expectation.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, I think you're correct in that if they choose to do it, then there are certain guidelines that they would need to follow, yes. So, yes, in a sense, there is a mandate, but they're not mandated to offer this. It's we're just giving them an opportunity, encouraging them to offer this to students in a time when, with the economic woes that we are in and the fluctuations that we may see in tuition, that it gives them an option to take this and for students to enroll in this and stabilize their tuition costs.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if I understand correctly, I believe they could do it now. So if they could do it now, then actually all you're doing is mandating, because you're telling them if they do it, this is how they need to do it.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, I don't believe, as Mr. Zutterberg said, they don't offer it anymore, so they're not doing it now. But
Mr. Chair, right. It's not the question of whether or not they are. It's the question of whether or not they can. And if they currently can, either Minsky or the university, if they can do this, they could set their own requirements, guidelines, situations that they'd like to see included in that. But as you've got it written, they're encouraged to do it. But if they're already able to do it, they don't necessarily need encouragement. But now you are mandating this is the guidelines they'd need to follow if they would do it.
Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, that's correct.
Would you like to renew your motion?
I would like to renew my motion that House File 1133 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And we lay it over as amended.
All right. Thank you. As amended.
All right. Thank you.
Well, welcome to committee, Chairman Ornis. Would you like to move your bill?
I would move House File 1130 to be recommended to pass and be referred to civil law.
Representative Ornis moves his bill, House File 1130, and recommended to pass and be referred to civil law. Would you please present your bill?
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll make this as brief as possible. This bill simply exempts post-secondary institutions that provide student data to the Office of Higher Education, the Department of Education, and other state agencies from liability related to the use, the destruction, or disclosure of the data by any of the public agencies or individuals having access to the data. It sounds complicated, but I have people here who will explain that. Right?
Chair Detmer, members of the committee, my name is Scott McMahon. I'm the Director of Government and Community Affairs of Minnesota Private College Council. I'm joined today by Phyllis Karasov, an attorney and a leading national expert on student data records. The Minnesota Private College Council represents the 17 nonprofit liberal arts schools around the state. We educate about 45,000 undergraduate students each year and about 15,000 graduate students. Currently, under state statute, every institution of higher education that participates in the state's financial aid programs is required to provide to the Office of Higher Education student unit record data for the purposes of research and evaluation of the programs. Historically, we've always been subject to some level of risk due to liability of misuse of this data. What's changing moving forward is historically we've shared the data with the Office of Higher Education, and that data has not been able to go beyond the walls of the agency that oversees our sector. What's changing moving forward is the state is moving forward with creating what's called the State Longitudinal Education Data System, which is going to be a data system that combines higher education data, K-12 data, and eventually workforce data. That's going to be accessible by the Office of Higher Education, the Minnesota Department of Education, the Office of Enterprise Technology, and eventually the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Under the existing model that we're operating where the data is shared only with Office of Higher Education, our institutions have had a willingness to accept the risk of liability based off the fact that the data is only going to be directly accessible by the agency that we have a close relationship with. Moving forward, the data is going to be available on all of our students by agencies that we don't work with, and the issue that our schools are raising at this point is that the level of risk that's going to come forward by a greater number of agencies having access to it is leading them into the world of uncomfort. What this would simply do is state that the schools are not liable for damages when there's some sort of security breach that happens with the data or misuse of data that happens once we transfer that data to the Office of Higher Education and the office then uses it themselves or makes this accessible in the longitudinal data system. Now, at this point, I will turn it over to Phyllis Karasov to get into more of the details on the liability side of things.
Welcome. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Good afternoon. I'm Phyllis Karasov, and I'm an attorney with Moore, Costello & Hart, a law firm here in the Twin Cities. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. Despite the best intentions of the various agencies to whom this data is going to be disclosed, the fact is that in today's electronic age, it is rather inevitable that there are incidents involving disclosure of confidential information. In recent years, there have been reports that over 285 million records have been compromised through security breaches. Just in 2011 alone, there have been many published incidents of disclosure of confidential information. The Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, which is a wonderful website on privacy, discusses all of the different security breaches that have occurred. And here in Minnesota, for example, there was a disclosure by the Minnesota Department of Education inadvertent, certainly, but meanwhile, there was confidential information about students at one of the charter schools that was inadvertently disclosed to the public. So there's a variety of civil claims that could be made by an institution of higher education student or family against the institutions who are providing these records to the state of Minnesota. There could be tortious invasion of privacy. There could be negligence, breach of contract, fraudulent misrepresentation, negligent misrepresentation, and probably other creative causes of action dreamed up by us lawyers. A student whose information is improperly disclosed would likely sue both the state of Minnesota and the institution that he or she attended, which shared that information pursuant to this SLEDS program. This proposed statute would apply to both public and private institutions of higher education. The state of Minnesota's liability would be limited by the Tort Claims Act and sovereign immunity if the claim fell within the coverage of the tort immunity statute. So because the state of Minnesota is subject to sovereign immunity, it would be natural that a claim would in particular be against an institution that, a private institution that is not covered by sovereign immunity, because now they would be the deep pocket and would be an even more attractive defendant to an aggrieved student. In addition to the potential civil liability, there's also a possibility of criminal liability arising from the disclosure of confidential data. So, for example, those who violate the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act can be guilty of a misdemeanor. There are several other states that have immunity statutes dealing with disclosure of student data in the situation similar to this, where there's a longitudinal study. And the state of Minnesota itself has many, many statutory grants of immunity. There are over 150 separate statutory provisions in Minnesota that provide some manner of immunity. And I won't go into those, but quite a few of them. In addition, there is a very recent lawsuit in Iowa that was filed, a class action filed in November of 2010 against the University of Hawaii for disclosure of private and personal information of students and alumni. So there is definitely a risk of liability for institutions of higher education that are providing this student data in connection with the SLEDS program. And so that's why we're seeking this statute that would grant immunity to both publics and privates who participate in that program. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the whoever is most appropriate to answer the question. I'm just reading the proposal. If the information that is provided is libelous, if it's just plain wrong, and it causes a problem, would this shield the institution of higher education from liability for providing libelous or wrong or harmful information?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Representative, the types of data that are currently going to be shared are factual, address, race, matriculation, whether they've transferred. I mean, there's nothing that potentially could be considered to be libelous. But the statute is protecting an institution if there is a breach by the Office of Higher Education or individuals or entities who are given access to that. So arguably, if something was false and it is improperly disclosed, yes, arguably that would be covered. But the kind of data that we're talking about, there's no... there's nothing subjective about it. It's factual information about the students.
So then,
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, to the author, then, you wouldn't object to some additional language that would simply say the sorts of information to which it would apply, which is what was just described. If it's limited to that, what I'm afraid of is, and that was a beautiful lawyer answer, and I mean that as a compliment coming from another lawyer, But you know exactly what you said, which is that the current stuff that's disclosed, you know, couldn't be libelous, it couldn't be harmful because it is what it is. But a year from now, or 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, if it became information that was, you know, I'm kind of a privacy advocate. I think Representative Holberg, if only she was here, because my guess is she would have concerns exponentially greater than mine. And that would be relative to if there's other types of information that were being disclosed. But all I'm suggesting to the author is perhaps you close down to the sorts of information that you're talking about. If it's birth dates and, I'm sorry, whatever you were describing, if it's very specific objective data, that's one thing. But it certainly shouldn't apply to subjective data or other sorts of things that might potentially cause a problem for...
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, this goes to civil law. Maybe we could, between now and then, look at some language if it suits and have it offered there.
I
happen to know the chair down there pretty well.
Yeah, I just, Mr. Chair and Chair Nornes,
that would.
I'm just trying to protect you from Representative Holberg. I've worked with her, and I've been on the wrong side of Representative Holberg, and we all know what side we want to be on with respect to Representative Holberg.
My opinion, Representative Nornes, do it in that committee than here.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Nornes, would you like to renew your motion?
I would renew my motion that House File 1130 be recommended to pass and be referred to civil law.
Representative Nornes renews his motion and moves House File 1130 be recommended to pass as referred to civil law. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Pass. Representative Nornes.
I've got just a couple of announcements to make. If you pay attention for just a moment, our next meeting, as you know, will be next Tuesday, a regular meeting time and place. House File 1101, which is our omnibus bill, will be taken up at that time. And if it gets to be a long day, we'll reconvene at 5:30 in room 200 on Tuesday. And all amendments and testimony will be heard at that time. Also, the delete everything amendment and spreadsheets are here in case anyone wants to pick them up, and also available on the website. So I think that covers it.
Okay. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
I don't care. I call that. Yeah.